Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking physical therapy on the program today. And we're starting by talking about gluteal tendinopathy. It affects your hips and your buttocks area. And our physical therapists are back once again to answer your questions. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
And Lori Tyne Brody back with us as well, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, great to see you again as well.
Awesome to be here on a beautiful Monday, Larry.
Tell you what, it is a beautiful day, and it'd be beautiful if you'd call in with your own physical therapy questions. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Lori, let's start with you. Today we're talking about gluteal tendinopathy. What is it?
So it is, a tendinopathy, so let's start with that. That is some kind of pathology of a tendon, and it's not specific as to whether or not it's an itis, tendinitis with an inflammation, or some other kind of pathology such as degeneration of the tendon. So gluteal, those are those big, as we know, gluteal muscles in your tush or your buttocks. So those muscles attach on the outside of your hip. So if you put your finger on that bone on the outside of your hip, those gluteal muscles attach kind of to the backside and around that bone. So you often get a tendinopathy where there is a change in tissue type. So that is either as the muscle transitions to tendon or the tendon transitions to bone. So here we often see the tendinopathy at that place where it transitions from tendon to bone, and it can create pain on the outside of your hip. And there are a number of structures there. So sometimes it's difficult to sort out which tissue is the cause of the problem. So they'll say, it's trochanteric bursitis. So on the outside of that bony prominence, you have a bursa, and the greater trochanteric bursa, and that can be irritated. And so they'll say, well, it's a bursitis, and no, it's a tendinitis. Oh, no, it's a tendinopathy. And it gets a little bit difficult to sort those things out. So what this study did was go over specific tests for that specific condition.
And Jill, you've got the results of some of that work.
Yes, that's exactly right, Larry. So because we know that between the low back and our hip and our SI joint, we've talked about this previously on the show, it's very difficult to determine the source of symptoms. Is that pain coming from your patient's back, or is it their SI joint, or is it their hip? So this study was done. It was a literature review to try and see if we could find some testing procedures that helped us diagnose the condition of greater trochanteric pain syndrome. And it had been about 10 years since anybody had done this thorough literature search. And so these authors chose to do that. And even after scouring the literature, unfortunately, they only found 6 studies that met their inclusion criteria. So their sample size was only about 250 or 275 hips. But the interesting thing that they found is that it's fairly easy to diagnose a greater trochanteric pain syndrome as your source of symptoms. If you have pain with palpation in that area, and if you have pain with testing the muscle, making it contract, in other words, resisting taking your hip away, you have a pretty good chance of having a diagnosis of greater trochanteric pain syndrome. And similarly, if you're not tender with palpation when you palpate over there and you don't have pain when you make that muscle fire, you can rule out greater trochanteric pain syndrome. So we have some pretty easy clinical tests that can help us rule in the condition, but that still leaves us with figuring out the million-dollar question of why. Yeah. So as Lori always says, why do you only get something on one side versus the other? So now we know that, gosh, you have this greater trochanteric pain syndrome, maybe you have gluteal tendinopathy, but it's still up to the physical therapist or the healthcare provider to determine why this gluteal tendon is flared up or why you have a bursitis on one side and not the other. So it's helpful. They actually said that clinicians should not use MRI findings because they found that there's people who have no hip pain who actually have findings on an MRI. So imaging doesn't really help. We really rely on our clinical tests, but this is just scratching the surface. We still have to determine why you're having it on that side.
You know, I want to go back to terms here for a second because I was reading this morning that Giannis Antetokounmpo has Achilles tendinitis. And we've got tendinitis, we have tendinosis, and we have tendinopathy.
Yes, we do. Tendinopathy is the overarching term that encompasses anything that relates to the tendon. Anything that ends with itis, Achilles tendonitis, patellar tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, and we can argue right or wrong, implies inflammation. So it implies that it's relatively acute and there's an inflammatory process going on. And Giannis may have that. He's young. He's, you know, and it could be an acute situation for him. And so he could actually have an inflammatory component going on. Tendinosis is actually referring to degenerative changes in the tendon. And I think Lori has something to say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, right. Lori.
And you can have both. Mm-hmm. So you can have a degenerative tendon with tendinosis, and you're going along just fine with your life, and you and your tendon are in homeostasis and agreement to your activity level. And then all of a sudden, you change your activity level, such as when I had a patient last week move, and she did the moving herself. Oh. And so she's carrying boxes and so on. So at that point, you can have a tendinitis superimposed upon a tendinosis. And at that point, you may just call it a tendinopathy and be done with it.
Right, exactly.
But as the clinician, you need to sort of sort those things out so that you know what the right treatment is for that. You might treat the acute symptoms of the itis right away, but know that as the inflammation subsides, you need to treat the underlying osis, which has a different treatment program.
Yeah.
Right. And so we hear the term plantar fasciitis thrown around all the time. And we know that the course of plantar fasciitis can take up to a year. You don't have that inflammatory process going on for a year. So the term plantar fasciitis isn't even technically correct. And interestingly, we used to always use the term adhesive capsulitis to diagnose a frozen shoulder. And they're getting away from that term. They're calling it a frozen shoulder now instead of adhesive capsulitis because they want people to understand that it goes beyond the inflammatory, the itis component, and there's more to it on the back end.
So what about treatments?
Yeah, for tendinosis.
Yeah, let's start there.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you ask that, Larry, and it's such a good question. Historically, we have always, and research has shown that the best way to get people over the hump with a chronic tendinosis or tendinopathy is through eccentric training, where you really, really, really have to load the tendon. So example, for an Achilles tendinopathy, it's not going up on your toes, but it's the lowering phase, lowering your heels down. There's been compelling research coming out that says, you know what? Just make the muscle work. It doesn't matter if it's an isometric, if it's an isotonic, if it's an eccentric, a concentric. So the literature used to be hard and fast on eccentrics, these heavy eccentrics. And it's the paradigm is shifting a little bit more. And it's basically saying, hey, get that thing stronger and do it however you can without instigating the most pain on the patient.
Yeah. So a few things about that. So the majority of time, especially if you're talking about athletic activities or even walking, it is the eccentric component that stirs the pot, which is sort of why it's been the focus of treatment. And there's been a lot of interest in a lot of research in the eccentric or the negative component of the exercises. Sort of the problem with the research is, you know, you throw everybody into the basket, and there are some people in that research study that would do well with a concentric or with an isometric or with an eccentric. And so when the research falls out at the end, it shows, yeah, you can use any of those. That being said, it doesn't mean that every patient is going to respond to any of those kinds of muscle contractions. The reason you go see a physical therapist is that person needs to look at you and look at your activity level and what brought them to you, and figure out if there is a correct kind of muscle contraction. Now, one last thing about that is every eccentric requires an isometric. Mm-hmm. And that is, you cannot do an eccentric contraction without doing an isometric first. So when you talk about doing eccentric contractions, you're actually talking about doing eccentrics and isometrics. The only one that's left out is the concentric. So it's the addition of the concentric or the shortening contraction.
Is there much we can do to avoid this problem?
Oh, if you have that, Larry, let's find it and let's sell it and let's retire. Because no, unfortunately, we don't. As a matter of fact, I had a woman at the gym ask me, we were talking actually about gluteal tendinopathy yesterday, and she said, well, is it more prevalent in active people than inactive people? And the answer is no. So there's no demographic that's at greater risk other than with gluteal tendinopathy. We know it's a little bit higher in women, but there's really no way of preventing it. We don't know what tips the cart into this tendinopathy. Would you agree with that, Lori?
Well, you know, if you look at people's history, it's usually a change in activity that'll do it. So again, you know, you are in, I always think of it as like you're in homeostasis. You and your body have agreed that I can walk 3 miles and I can walk 3 miles on a level surface. Well, all of a sudden I'm walking 3 miles on a hilly surface and your body says, wait a minute, you did not ask me about this. So a lot of times it's a change in activity that does it. And then if you layer a change in activity on top of some biomechanical consideration. So for example, this weekend, it's a beautiful weekend and I'm out on the trail. And, you know, Jill, I'm sure you're the same way. You cannot help yourself.
But watch people's gait.
You see people running, you see people walking, and you just want to stop them and say, have you thought about trying this? You know, because that it's people's gait, you know, or you see them mechanically, their knee alignment is way off and they're compensating at their hips or their back or whatever. So, you know, you layer a change in activity on top of that, and then that's a recipe for things heading south in a hurry.
Yeah, I got out to play golf for the first time this weekend, so I got in 27 holes.
Larry.
Hey, Larry, that's exactly what we're talking about.
I walked over 9 miles. pushing a golf cart around.
So this is exactly what we're talking about. Yep. Like, why not start with 9 and 9 or something like that? But no, you had to go out and do 27. So this is what we're talking about. It's no different than people who went out on this beautiful past weekend and decided to rake their entire yard.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I would say to those people, you wouldn't go run a marathon without training, would you? And they say, oh, of course not. But that's kind of what you did with your shoulder. Because your shoulder isn't used to that. And you just made your shoulder do the same thing over and over and over and over while you raked up your yard. So like Lori said, there is a tipping point. It's difficult to predict what all goes into that. But there's usually an increase in activity as part of it.
Well, I don't know how much apathy there is. It's sort of an all body apathy today. Lots of sore muscles today.
So, but the thing is, Larry, and this brings up a really good point. You have cause and effect. So you did something different and you know why, and it's sore muscles, not your joint. Are they more just muscles?
It's muscle.
Okay, great. Fine. So it'll go away in a few days.
That's what I'm hoping. Jill Tynan, this is Bob Laurie Tynan Brody, our guest today, and we'll get to Tony and Waukesha and Barbara and Grand Marsh, and we'll get to you as well if you want to join in with a question. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins at the board today as our technical directors. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking physical therapy on the program today. We've zeroed in a bit on glutes and hips, but we'll take other PT questions as well with our two guests, Jill Tynan Nissenbaum, Laurie Tynan Brody. They come by every month, and it's always a pleasure to have them with us. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's turn to Tony and Waukesha now. Tony, thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome.
What's on your mind, or maybe on your neck or back or whatever?
Well, don't get me started, because I get the plantar fasciitis issue. Just developed the, I think, groin or hip, I'm not sure. Playing tennis a little bit too much over the weekend here. All of a sudden, it just kind of, when I step out wide, it kind of, you know, it's kind of, I can't tell where the pain is coming from.
Yeah.
So is it mostly in your groin?
I'm not sure. I can't tell. I move around and try to make it hurt, and it doesn't, and then I make a move, and it does. So it does feel toward the inner part of the upper thigh, let's say.
If you're sitting, Tony, and you take your hands and make two fists and put them between your knees and squeeze that fist, does that bother you?
No.
Okay.
And the load may not be high enough.
Correct.
So if you were out playing tennis involves a lot of lateral movements. And so it could be some overuse of those muscles in your inner thigh. And it may be that the isometric squeeze test that Jill's talking about, which is the typical test we use for this, isn't a high enough load to elicit your symptoms. But if you catch it just right, you know, with the right amount of force moving a certain way, then you'll feel it. So, you know, I'd probably spend some extra time stretching today. Uh-huh. And see if it resolves. If the tennis was, you know, in terms of the amount of activity was new for you, it may take a couple of days to resolve.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting. Tennis is, like Laurie mentioned, a lot of lateral movement. So side to side, when typically walking, things like that, is a different motion. So you have used those muscles differently, Tony. So it sounds like you and Larry get to do some stretching for the next few days.
Right. And for your plantar fasciitis, if you haven't tried a night splint, I would do that. If you haven't done that.
Okay. Tony, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Barbara and Grand Marsh, on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Well, first of all, I'm not a runner. I'm not a walker. I'm 85 years old. 2 weekends ago, I went to visit my brother and had to sleep on his couch.
Oh.
When I left there, about a day later, the pain was excruciating in my left leg on the outside. I went to the doctor. She diagnosed it as an IT band problem. Mm-hmm. The only thing that he said that I can do is to take Tylenol and one ibuprofen every 6 hours, and she gave me some exercises to use. And one of the exercises, or most of them, once I would try them, they would have to call an ambulance.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so Barbara, this could be from laying on the couch, very, very much so, because if you didn't have adequate support and your hips were uneven, your knees are coming together, you could have very, very much irritated your iliotibial band or the muscle that goes with it. So the band itself runs from your hip down to your knee, but it is connective tissue. So it doesn't stretch anything like that. There is a muscle in it, your tensor fascia lata, which could be a problem. You could have a little bit of greater trochanteric bursitis with this. You could have a little bit of a gluteal muscle irritation. I would suggest seeing a physical therapist. Lori, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, in terms of the exercises, what I often see is people sort of think it's an all or none. So I do it this way or I don't do it. Sometimes it takes just a wee bit of a modification of doing that exercise to make it work for you. So if they usually will give you a stretching exercise. So if you can back that stretching exercise down a bit to where you're feeling a little bit of tension or stretching, you know, that stretching feeling, but not pain, then go ahead and do that. If no matter how you modify that, like you're tweaking your hip a little bit, you're turning, you're leaning, you're shifting your weight a little bit, and none of that improves it, then for sure stop doing it. But yeah, see a physical therapist, because there's a number of things that could be done to help you get over this.
Barbara, good luck. Thank you for calling. Jim, who is calling from the Shawamigan National Forest, I believe. Jim, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the ladies for all their information. Okay, I'm 76 years old. 7 years ago, I was running down a mountain in Colorado trying to meet up with my grandchildren, and I jumped over a creek. And I'm not 18 years old. I used to be able to a broad jump, and I couldn't make it. So anyway, I came down with my lower leg totally extended, and all the weight of my body hit on that knee joint, my right knee joint, and it felt like maybe it was trying to bend the wrong way. I think I heard a snap. And anyway, the rest of the day down the mountain, I was acting like, what was it in Gunsmoke? Chester.
Chester.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay, so the question is, I think it might be an ACL. I don't know, but could it be repaired after 7 years? And if it can be, how long would it take for me to recover?
Hmm.
Those are great questions. And so an ACL is typically reconstructed. In other words, they don't repair the tissue that's there. You actually get a new one from different tissue. So an ACL reconstruction can actually occur at any time. It could be 10 years out, 15 years out, whatever. I guess my first question is, if it's been 7 years, have you been managing okay without it? Because an ACL reconstruction does require lengthy rehabilitation. You're probably talking 9 to 11 months to get back to what you want to get back to, Jim. So my question is, I guess, and I can tell Lori's thinking the same thing, is what have you been doing for the last 6 years? Have you modified? Have you tried PT? Anything like that?
Thank you. No, I'm a minimalist. I live off a few thousand dollars a year, grow all my own food, and heat and cook with wood. But anyway, I've been just tolerating it. I've lost stability in the right knee, but I can do things, my work. And I was up on a ladder here this spring cutting limbs off a tree, and I twisted it, and it swelled way the heck up again, and I was useless for a couple of weeks. But anyway, I don't know if I can last 9 months without, you know, I have to move to town and watch old MASH movies or something. But thank
you. If you're going to watch anything, watch MASH. But I would go see an orthopedic surgeon and have my knee evaluated. You kind of want to know the status of the meniscus. You want to know the status of your joint surfaces. You want to know what your options are. It doesn't mean you have to do anything, but you want to collect data. So, you know, if you have a little bit of instability here or there, I don't worry about it unless you're up on a ladder with a chainsaw. Then I start to worry about you having instability in your knee. It may be that you wear a brace for high demand activities. And other than that, you're fine. Sometimes if you go get your ACL reconstructed this many years later, and my guess is you probably have meniscus tears as well, you start to constrain the knee, then you sometimes end up with more troubles than you had at the beginning.
Agreed.
So you may do well with a brace and some physical therapy rather than thinking about going through a whole reconstruction process. But I can't make that call without more information. So I guess if it were me, I'd get more info
Yep. Right. And I would definitely go the route of conservative care first. I mean, you haven't, there's many things, Jim, that you could do at your house independently with all your equipment you have there to do some good strengthening, to do some good balance. And again, Lori, I agree with you. I was thinking of a knee sleeve or something just to give him a little more proprioception. So I would try all of that first before I even considered surgery.
Good luck, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Susan emailed us wondering what are the best or the basics, I should say, of desk posture while using a computer. Their daughter has terrible neck pain and spends apparently a lot of time in front of a computer.
Yeah. So you just from a setup perspective, if you're going to be sitting, you want your hips and knees at 90 degrees and your feet flat on the floor. You want your forearms supported. So if you can get a desk chair with armrests, or if you can rest them on the desktop, that is great. Your elbow should be bent to close to 90 degrees. So you shouldn't be reaching out to get your keyboard. And then here's where the challenge comes, I think, for a lot of people that we're such a mobile society, everyone has laptops. And if your keyboard is set up right, your screen is probably not set up right and you have to look down. If you put your screen in the right place, so your eyes are looking straight out, then your keyboard isn't in the right place. So for some people, I suggest one of those silicone portable keyboards to go with their laptop so they can actually set their laptop up on something higher so their eyes stay level and that their arms are at the appropriate kind of height, if you will.
So, and that assumes that you keep your laptop at a 90 degree angle.
Right.
You can also tip up the backside of your, the base of your laptop so it stays low and raises the top. So if you Google posture, you can find many, many good photos and pictures of what your posture should look like. So for those of us who are visual learners, just going online and Googling good posture. I'm sure the American Physical Therapy Association has a photo up there somewhere, but take a look at it. And part of it is not just the computer, but also on your phone, where people are tend to be looking down at their phone all the time. So making sure that whenever you're on whatever device you're on, that you're using good posture, that your chin is sort of tucked in and you're not goosenecking forward, so that you keep your basically your ear in line with your shoulder when you're looking from the side. That's where your head should be relative to your trunk.
Let's take a call from Carol in Appleton next. Hi, Carol.
Hi, good morning. My question is regarding my hands. I'm 63 years old, and it's primarily the involvement is in my pinkies, the right more than the left. And if I bump that pinky in any way, it shoots pain. It kind of is a burning, like a nerve pain. I do know that I have some carpal tunnel, but I read that pinkies aren't involved in carpal tunnel.
Right. So typically the median nerve is affected with carpal tunnel syndrome, and that goes to your thumb and your index finger and part of your middle finger. The pinky, that side of your hand, is innervated by your ulnar nerve. And you could get hung up at your elbow. You can get what's called cubital tunnel, kind of right where your funny bone is. And you could get some hang up of your ulnar nerve there. And then the other thing, Lori, I always think about is coming from the cervical spine if it's bilateral.
Yeah. If you're having symptoms on both sides, you know, one more than the other, it could be coming from your neck. So anytime we see things in both arms, especially if they're somewhat symmetrical, we look for that central cause. So seeing a physical therapist who can examine your neck and your elbow, and there's fairly simple tests like the Tinel test they use to look at involvement of the nerve at your elbow. Could certainly, a quick examination could sort out the cause of your problems. And a few exercises could certainly relieve that and prevent any further deterioration or increase in those symptoms. So that's where I'd go with this. But you're right, little finger is not carpal tunnel.
Yeah, all right. Carol, thank you for calling. Good luck. Joe in Milwaukee, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for a great program. Hi, ladies. I'll be real quick. If you can imagine a stairwell in a hotel versus the elevator, we were in a condo in Florida, and she was taking the stairs versus the elevator for exercise. And it was dewy that morning. She slipped and fell butt down on a concrete stair edge.
Ouch.
Never told me until 2 days later, and I have never seen the colors or the the bruising in my life. We can laugh now. I get it, and you've seen it, but I mean, Larry, ladies, it was amazing. Well, iced it down. Whatever. This is 3 years ago. There's a roll, a knot of cartilage, tendon, muscle in her left buttock that only deep tissue massage, which is a job in itself, makes the alleviate the pain. She's gone to some doctors since, you know, and the x-rays for her hip, whatever, but something's rolled up. She severed, she did something to where I'm trying. This is a great show. Hopefully you can help with it. There's a knot in her butt and I don't know what it is, and like to help her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Well, yeah, chances are that she ruptured either fully ruptured a little muscle, so back
a rotator
there,
maybe.
Yeah, the piriformis, maybe, for people talk about the piriformis or what I call the flying gamelli brothers, mm-hmm. gamellus superior and gamellus inferior, little hip rotator muscles, or it could be some fibers of one of the bigger muscles, but clearly she has more than likely ruptured some of those. That's one possibility. The other is, given all that bruising, she could have had, well, what I affectionately refer to as a hematomator.
A hematoma, yeah.
A big hematoma in the muscle, which when your body tries to heal it, will heal it with scar tissue. So she could have a big wad of scar tissue there, either from a hematoma or from a partial or full muscle rupture. So...
Right. It makes sense that nothing showed up on imaging, right. on plain right. films, because this is soft tissue.
Right.
So having her see a physical therapist to kind of figure out what it is it muscle weakness? Is it a scarred down hematoma? Whatever could help. Now it's been 3 years. And so, you know, if there is scar tissue, you can get some improvement with the alignment. The fact that she responds to deep tissue makes me feel like there is some sort of muscle involvement. So maybe with appropriate stretching, a little bit of strengthening, you could get it a little bit better, but you're not going to make that big bulge go away permanently.
Yeah, no, not at 3 years. Basically you have 12 weeks to remodel dense connective tissue. And after that, you're unlikely to change it. So, but a physical therapist might help her with some self deep tissue mobilization activities. There's a lot of tools out there that she may be able to use. Like she gets up in the morning and she gets on her little ball and she really goes after that. And then the rest of her day, she's good. So, yeah, but I'd have her see a physical therapist and see if she can figure out specifically what muscle you're talking about here.
Go for it, Joe. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Paul in Menominee, Marinette. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hey. Hello. Thanks for the show. I always appreciate the physical therapy program. Anyway, I was listening, and Tony had this problem, and he was playing tennis. I have a similar problem with pickleball. It's an injury about 2 months ago. I was trail running and sort of shock loaded my left leg. And I have pain at the insertion of an adductor tendon right at the groin. Almost seems like it's, you know, the most proximal part of the whole area. And I can run, I can ride bike, no problem. But trying to play pickleball or I can't run, I can walk. But trying to play pickleball or running, this just aggravates. And then my question is, would it be better to try a graded stretching program, or would try to strengthen that muscle, or what would be some advice on that?
Yes.
All of the above.
All of the above. So you are correct. You have your adductor muscles attached right up at your pubic bone. The other thing that I would want to check as a physical therapist is just to make sure that your pubic bone alignment is still good. If you had a hard enough muscle contraction, Paul, that you really irritated this muscle, your pubic bones can actually come a little bit off of alignment, and you can do some different muscle energy techniques to make sure that your pubic bones are in good alignment. So for that and all those things you said, you talked about, should I strengthen, should I stretch, I would definitely see a physical therapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to need to have a graded progressive program. So stretching, yes, but you can overstretch and aggravate it. So this comes down to the dosage. So dosing your activities to load the muscle and the tendon attachment. So again, here we are, we talked at the top of the hour. Anytime you have a change in the constitution of the tissue. So here you have tendon transitioning to bone. It actually goes through four different types of tissue in that transition zone from tendon to bone. And those take a long time to recover because there's no blood supply. So getting the dosage right on which activities at which load to help you get over this. If you continue to try to run and then stop, or play pickleball and then stop, you're never going to make forward progress.
Paul, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And let's turn to Liz in Madison. Liz, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Oh. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. So my question is, I have been sort of plagued with sciatic nerve pain I'm 53. It started 20 years ago. I had my initial injury in yoga. I was overstretching. I had been a runner. I've runner my whole life. And I was very tight, and then I started overstretching. Well, I herniated my L5-S1. And ever since then, every couple of years, I'll get sciatic nerve pain, SI joint. I've been diagnosed with piriformis syndrome, SI joint dysfunction, chronic low back pain, tight IT band. It's all on the right side. Never get left side sciatica unless it's gotten really, really bad. And that hasn't happened for years. But I've been in the stretch. I was a personal trainer. So I'm one of those type A, just have done way too much activity. And have seen a lot of PTs. And my problem is I need to see a PT that I can tell all this stuff to. retroverted pelvis. And what I don't want to do is give them like an entire list of things and then they're overwhelmed. So.
Yeah. So who does Liz approach and,
Well, I would see a physical therapist who specializes in spine and in chronic conditions. So, you know, my guess is if you herniated at L5-S1, you probably have some weakness in the disc, the outer layers of the disc there. You probably have some facet joint arthritis or arthropathy there. And whenever you overdo it, you flare that and creates stenosis where that nerve root comes out and you get symptoms. All the rest of this SI joint, the retroversion, the ITB, the piriformis, all that stuff is probably secondary to the primary problem and represents compensations for the pain that you have had. So a good physical therapist can take all this in. It's all probably interrelated. And one of the most important things, the take-home messages as a PT, is you treat what's in front of you today.
Right, exactly.
So you take a look, you do an examination, you see where the most common impairments are, what things need to be treated first in order for these other things to fall in place.
Exactly. And I think seeing somebody who, like Lori talked about, somebody who specializes in spine, maybe an orthopedic clinical specialist would be a really good idea. A chronic pain clinic may not be a bad idea. And I know some people think, oh, chronic pain, oh my gosh, they're just going to put me out to pasture. That is not the case at all. Similar to what Lori said, they're going to treat what's in front of you. So if you come with your list of goals, they will try and get you back to that as best as they can. So you may have to rethink your approach a little bit on this, but I definitely agree with everything Lori said. And I might try a pool just to unload her a little bit too.
Yeah, there you go. Liz, good luck. Yeah. I appreciate your call.
Yeah. This is pretty classic of what we see every day at the spine clinic. You know, people rarely come in with one problem. They typically, when they show up at the spine clinic, they've had a long history of of things. So this isn't that unusual for us to hear that kind of history.
Jill Tine-Nissenbaum and Lori Tine-Brody, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. A variety of physical therapy questions on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tine-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Let's take a call. Mike in Milwaukee, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I was diagnosed with a foot issue October of 2022. Podiatrist took some x-rays. They didn't see any fractures or anything. The left toe continued to become very immobile. There's a lot of swelling. So a few months later, the doctor referred me to get an MRI. The MRI showed vascular necrosis on my outer sesamoid bone of my toe. Since then, I was have been doing some shockwave therapy and acupuncture, which has improved the mobility quite a bit in the toe. However, I still have pain. You know, if I really push off it, say sprinting, I can't work on like ladder rungs anymore. But apparently, the only cure for this is actual surgical removal of the sesamoid bone. And I was just wondering at what point, if the bone can never heal or if it's dead bone, is there a point in my life that I should just get the surgery and get it over with? Or if I'm fairly mobile now, I can't sprint, but I can still play golf. I can still walk somewhat normally. Should I wait until the pain becomes unbearable or I can't walk to actually have the surgery?
This is a great question. So it's interesting. I don't know that I've ever heard of vascular necrosis of one sesamoid.
Nor have I.
So you have two sesamoids, just for the listeners, on the bottom of your foot that are under kind of your great toe. And there's some tendons that run through there and it just gives them a mechanical advantage. It's similar to your kneecap or your patella and your quads, and it gives that muscle a better length tension relationship. So vascular necrosis of the lateral sesamoid. So would they remove both sesamoids? Have they ever talked about that, Mike?
No, they just said they would remove the outer one. The other one showed fine in the MRI. It was just the outer one. And then the first podiatrist were like, oh, yeah, we can kind of see a fracture in there, but.
Okay.
So have you seen an orthopedic surgeon, or is this all through the podiatrist?
I've seen two podiatrists, one that specializes in the shockwave therapy, and that's my current podiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah, that's what I've seen so far, okay. But no orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah, this is an interesting and unusual enough condition.
Right.
But I might look for someone's opinion, someone who does foot and ankle surgery, like there's some folks in your area who orthopedic surgeons specialize in it, and get a perspective from somebody in just a slightly different profession to see what their opinion is. And they may have seen more of these than others have. I would just, and that being said, I would continue on my activities as they are right now, because you can do pretty much everything you need to do. You did say you could walk somewhat normally, so I wouldn't want you walking around with a limp. I wouldn't Right. want you favoring that foot for any reason, because it's going to wreak havoc elsewhere. Has your podiatrist made you any kind of orthoses, or have you used, for example, a simple donut pad underneath your great toe to help offload that sesamoid?
Yeah, the first podiatrist made a donut-shaped bandage and okay. had that on for a few weeks. She initially diagnosed it just a bone bruise and said, sure. hey, these injuries take a long time to heal just for the mm-hmm. limited blood flow to that area.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And after that failed, you know, I was like, this is not getting any better. She did make custom orthotics that, for the left side, took a little pressure off that sesamoid area.
Okay.
And then I also had a question like, well, how long should I wear these these orthotics, if the condition persists, is it going to start to affect my gait and mess up other things? I do kind of limp a little bit, so that's what my primary care doctor was right. concerned about. Was
right,
yeah,
and I 100% agreed,
yeah, and agreed. I would agree with that. And theoretically, the orthoses is designed to help you walk more normally.
Right.
Like, it shouldn't make you walk abnormally. So in terms of that question of how long should I wear it, it should be forever.
Correct.
As long as you're having symptoms in that toe, because it is theoretically supposed to normalize your gait. So if it's not doing it, that's not the right orthosis for you.
Yeah.
So I'd say this is a complicated enough problem. I would just get one more opinion on this.
Right.
And then make a decision.
Good luck, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Jim emailed us with a question. What's the best exercise for an Achilles strain? He's 70, 72. A twist occurred 6 months ago.
Oh, geez, 6 months ago and he's still having symptoms?
Well, he probably has an tendinopathy. Remember how we talked about that at the top of the hour?
I do remember how we talked about that, yeah. So if he is still having symptoms after 6 months, I would go in and see somebody. So the two tendons, the Achilles and the patellar tendon at your knee, those are notorious for becoming chronic because you use them with every step you take of the day. And so if this hasn't resolved in 6 months, and my guess is that Jim has not been sitting around doing nothing, but Jim has been trying to get over it and still hasn't, he clearly needs more guidance. And this comes down to dosage. Mm-hmm. What exercise? Concentric, eccentric, isometric, as we talked about at the top of the show, and at what dosage? Does he need a heel lift? Is there something else going on farther up the kinetic chain that's contributing to this perpetuating? So there's just a number of unanswered questions, I think, and just a visit or two to get answers to those so you can get on the right path would be my suggestion. Jill, do you disagree with me?
No, I agree 100%. I think that's a great plan.
Carol in central Wisconsin called, couldn't stay with us, wonders what's the therapy for Baker's cyst on the back of the knee?
Mm. Yeah, I think we had this question not too long ago. So Baker's cyst is a weakness or a bleb in your capsule of your knee joint. So I think we used the analogy last time of a weakness in your tire, and you have that little spot that sticks out. And so what happens is fluid goes back there, kind of escapes back there, and then it gets stuck back there. And then it might be hard to bend your knee, straighten your knee, things like that. The Baker cyst is typically a sign that there's something going on intra-articularly within your knee joint itself. So it may be that Carol has maybe some arthritic changes going on. Maybe she's got some small degenerative meniscal tears, something like that. So you don't necessarily treat the Baker cyst. You treat the condition that caused the Baker cyst in the first place. So yeah. Having her see a physical therapist to see to kind of get to the root of it is probably a good idea.
Right. And then a rehab program for whatever that condition is. And then just teaching her how to manage it. You know, if she's going to be on her feet a lot, if she's, you know, going to Disney for 3 days, she may want to use something like a knee sleeve to prevent swelling. So basically the knee swells and then it pushes out in that weak spot in the back of the knee. So preventing the excessive swelling in the first place is one of the simple strategies you have.
Alice emailed, what are your opinions of the new Stretch Lab storefronts?
So I have seen them popping up. I am going to be honest that I have not investigated. I have not visited one myself. And I am unsure of who the personnel are that are working there. So I don't know enough about them to answer that question, I guess. Lori, do you have any thoughts?
I don't know who's running them, but basically stretching is a good thing if done appropriately, with correct technique and at the right dosage.
And if you're not hypermobile.
Oh, righto.
So you have to make sure that stretching is indicated, I guess. That's my first thought is stretching indicated? And then all those things that Lori talked about.
Yeah.
Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today as we talk physical therapy, and they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org, and we'll be back right after this quick look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with our favorite physical therapists on the program today. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, and Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Questions for them? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Roger in Grantsburg next. Roger, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, Larry. How you doing, Larry? Yeah. It's okay for if you use my line, those girls so rock. This Roger with the bad foot that wore to Kiss shoes and broke my foot when I was a kid, you know. I've got some questions about I'm having problems with that, still with that foot, but I'm having plantar fasciitis. And is hydration, I'm really bad at forgetting to drink water. And would that have any issues of spurring on that plantar fasciitis or poor hydration? Was that anything involved in that?
Probably not, Roger. Although staying hydrated is it's really important for your overall health. So the easiest thing to do is get yourself some fancy, lovely water bottle that you look at and you go, oh, I should take a drink. So our mother used to fill up her water bottle in the morning and she made herself drink twice during the day.
Yep.
She'd fill it up and there she was always on that water. So I don't think it has anything to do with your plantar fasciitis. If you haven't tried, you know, my favorite night splint, the Darko, I love the name of that. It's like a, you know, the Dark Knight or something. The Darko Night Splint is a really dynamite night splint. And one of the few things that has in a clinical practice guideline has strong evidence for successful conservative management of plantar fasciitis. The downside is you have to wear it for a couple months before you're going to notice results. But But I do that. And so if you have a history of an injury to that foot and you know that's why you have plantar fasciitis on that side, okay. But if not, you know, seeing a physical therapist to see if there's anything about how you move, anything about the mobility of your, for example, your big toe, your ankle, that are perpetuating your plantar fascia symptoms, you should see somebody if you haven't.
Good luck, Roger, and thank you very much for calling. Maxine in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Maxine.
Hi. About 12 years ago, I was diagnosed with a labral tear after a 14-mile downhill hike. And through the years, I was prescribed gabapentin, which I've been taking regularly. And it's just the last 3 to 4 months, it's gotten a lot worse. I do have an appointment with the primary care doctor in May to start figuring out what I can do. And I've done lots of physical therapy. I do exercises every morning. I'm wondering if you have any advice for me.
Well, so you were diagnosed with a labral tear in your hip. So, and you haven't had any imaging done since then, Maxine?
I can't remember the last time I had any imaging.
Okay. So that's good. So it may be worthwhile to get some repeat imaging to see how things have changed or progressed over time for you. If you are starting to what we call fail conservative care, in other words, you've done all of your exercises and you've been compliant and diligent, you've done everything we've asked you to do, then there are other options before you would go down the path of surgery, including an injection. So they may try an injection to see if that alleviates your pain, or they may look at your MRI and say, you know what, it's surgery time and it's time to kind of have a labral repair, if you will. So there are many options out there for you. But I think seeing your primary care and kind of let's see where we are at this stage, this point in time now would be very helpful. And it may be that maybe those exercises you've been doing for a while also need a tune-up. So it may be that not only you see your primary care physician, maybe a referral back to physical therapy would be helpful too.
Yeah.
Lori?
Yeah. The pool would be a great place for you as well. So, and if they do decide that surgery is the right thing for you right now, the better shape you're in before your surgery, the faster and easier your recovery will be. But, you know, 12 years is a long time to be on gabapentin.
Yeah.
So thinking about what your alternatives are, I think is the right decision. And I'm glad you're going to see your primary and start to find a new path forward for yourself with this hip.
Yeah. Good luck, Maxine. Appreciate your call. Nadine in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nadine.
Hi. Hi. I have a question. I have suffered for over a year now from peripheral for neuropathy that is chemo-induced. My doctor says to me that the nerves will not regenerate, and I probably will keep that condition for the rest of my life. I'm on Lyrica for indefinitely. And I wonder, one physical therapist told me that I would benefit from red light, infrared therapy, and TENS therapy to the cost of about $7,500. That's what you wanted to start. So I don't know what your opinion is about those two modes of therapy.
So I don't have much to say about red light therapy. There's not a lot of evidence on that. There is evidence for TENS unit for pain relief if the neuropathy is causing a lot of pain. And you can order your own TENS unit off the internet for $50 or less. So you don't need to be spending thousands of dollars on this with you know, someone providing a, for example, a TENS treatment for you. Typically, when our patients want a TENS unit or they were referred from a physician for treatment and one of the suggestions is a TENS unit, we will help our patients figure out where to buy one and then help them set it up so that they can provide those treatments themselves. But in terms of the red light, exactly. I would say no on that.
I would agree.
There you go, Nadine. Thank you so much for calling. Peter in Madison read in the New York Times that there's a place in Spain that grows stem cells and injects them into shoulders and knees to rebuild lost cartilage. Wonders if you've heard of that, and is that the future?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of research into stem cell therapy these days. There's obviously some controversy around it. But the thinking is a stem cell is a kind of cell that can form different kinds of tissue. So cartilage or tendon or whatever, it just needs the right signal. So that kind of research is still really in its infancy right now. And so we don't have any long-term data on it. We don't have any, you know, institutions that are doing stem cell injections regularly. It's a little bit of a first cousin to people have heard of PRP or where they do autologous blood injections using someone's own blood and some of those cells to stimulate a healing response. Stem cells are one step back from that.
Right. So there's similar to that when you can have a procedure done when you have articular cartilage defects in your knees, and they do harvest some of your native cells and they send them away to some magical lab which populates those, and then those get reinjected back in your knee. So when he's talking about growing cells, I'm wondering if that's what he's referring to, is there are laboratories out there that can they put them in trips, all this fancy trypsin, and then you can loosely kind of populate your own tissue. And I'm wondering if that's what he's referring to.
Possibly. And it's an area of ongoing robust research. And so, you know, just stay posted on what's available and where it is. And if one is considering having a procedure where these are injected, you just need to know if it's a reputable place and where the cells are coming from, right, and how they're obtained, stored, and so on.
Jerry in Prairie du Chien emailed us, recently experienced immobilizing neck pain, and recent cervical neck x-rays showed the following: advanced multi-level degenerative disc disease with facet arthropy that has progressed from prior imaging. The facet joints are located between two different vertebrae. And he wants a translation of that. How do you prevent, or how can you prevent or minimize neck pain and immobilization? He's currently on a 10-day regimen of prednisone and is responding well to that.
Yep.
Yeah. So degenerative disc disease, unfortunately, is not that uncommon in the cervical spine. And the facets are the tiny little joints in the back of the neck. And in the neck, we have something called tripodism, where you actually weight bear a fair amount, even though it's not a lot of weight bearing because it's just your head, but you do actually weight bear through your facets normally. And so those facets are kind of at an increased risk of experiencing arthropathy or degenerative changes and narrowing in that area. So basically what Jerry has is he's got a lot of compression through all his vertebral segments, compressing his disc and then compressing the facet joints, causing some arthropathy, which can be very painful.
Right, right. So those little facet joints are just a smaller version of, for example, your knee joint.
Right.
It is a synovial joint with articular cartilage and synovial fluid. And that joint is adjacent to the opening where your nerve roots come out. which is also adjacent to your disc. So you have a little disc bulge. It narrows the opening where your nerve root comes out. Then if your facet joint is also swelling because of the arthritis, it also narrows the opening where your nerve root comes out. And that's where you get the radiculopathy down your arm. So physical therapy, there's a lot we can do in physical therapy for this kind of condition to teach people how to manage it. Because it's not going to change if people say, well, you can't make arthritis go away. No, but it's often not the arthritis itself that causes symptoms, but it's the inflammation that results from overuse or things like that, that create an inflammation in an arthritic joint.
Barbara emailed, wonders if you could talk about the sartorius muscle.
I would love
Sounds
to talk
like a fine wine.
I would love to talk about the sartorius muscle, and I'm chuckling out loud because one of my coworkers in my where I work had a grandmother whose maiden name was Sartorius.
Oh.
So every time we talk about the sartorius, we just say Grandma Sartorius. It is, fun fact, Barbara, it is the longest muscle in the body. It attaches on the outside of your hip, and it straps across your femur, across your thigh bone, and attaches at the inside of your knee. So it does different things, like it flexes your hip, it rotates your hip, and it flexes your knee and does all sorts of stuff. And I'm not sure why she's curious about the sartorius, what she wants to know about it. Other than those fun facts, yeah. It's...
You use it when you uncross your legs.
Yes. And there are people who I will have a tendency to they'll recruit it instead of their hip flexors. And so I see people who just need a really good sartorius stretch every once in a while.
I think I've only given a sartorius stretch once in my life.
Oh, we give them out in athletics, we give them out a little bit more because we do weird things. But yeah, I'm not sure what else she wants to know about it, but that's pretty cool.
That's a lot of fun facts.
It is a lot of fun facts.
About a muscle, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was the longest muscle.
It is the longest muscle in the body, Larry. There you go.
Learn something new every day.
Absolutely.
You can use that at your next party.
Phil in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Quick question. I'm 91 years old. I walk a mile and a quarter to a mile and a half every day. I walk correctly. Can I anticipate a knee injury or replacement coming up, because all my friends are getting it? If I walk correctly, I don't have any problems. Can I anticipate getting them from walking every day?
I'm sorry, I missed the question. I was laughing.
Phil's wondering if he walks a mile and a half every day, and he's wondering if he will get... This could result in a knee injury over time, just if he does it 7 days a week.
Oh, no, it will keep him from getting a knee injury.
Exactly, and probably a heart attack.
Exactly.
So, no, as long as, and you said you walked correctly, Phil, so that's great. Sounds like you're very conscious of that. Wearing good shoes is important. Being on a good surface is important. So, no, I would have no concerns about doing that, and good for you.
Yeah, good for you. So, probably once a year at least you'd want to replace those shoes about every 500 miles or so.
Absolutely.
Jim in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call and a good segue. Speaking of knees, I had a knee surgery about 4 years ago now, and I've been struggling with range of motion. And just a little background, after I had my knee replacement, I did have the, manipulation under anesthesia. And then I got better range of motion, and it locked up again with scar tissue. And then I actually went in and had revision surgery about a year after that. But I still continue to struggle, and it seems like the older I get, the less range of motion I have. So my question is there any research or are there anything new out there or recommendations you'd try?
Probably not. So why did they do the revision?
Pretty much same. Well, not they didn't do it. Maybe I misspoke, but they went in and cleared up the scar tissue.
Oh, they did a debridement.
You're correct.
Okay. Sometimes they'll do a revision if they realize the first joint they put in was the wrong size. I've had that happen that was not the right size. And then they go in for a revision. But But yeah, you're must just be somebody that lays down a lot of scar tissue. There right. are people like that, and it's really tough. It is dense connective tissue. Again, after 12 to 16 weeks, the remodeling is very slow and not very robust. So given your history of both a manipulation and a debridement, is there anything new? No, there's not anything new. You just have to be diligent about continuing to do your stretching every day. I mean, it's an everyday thing or you will lose range. So it's like all things in life. If you don't use it, you lose it. So, you know, in terms of daily activities for example, stair clearance, you need about 60 degrees of knee flexion, a little bit more going down the stairs. Are you going down the stairs foot over foot?
Yeah, it's getting a little tougher. I noticed the most when I hopped on the bike again this year, this last weekend, and it's like, man, I lost a lot. So I'm hoping I can get that back, at least so I can bike, but I don't know.
Right. Yeah, right. So, yes, so get back on your bike, and this just tells you what you have to do in the future. And for most people in their daily activities, they do not take their knee through a full range of motion.
Correct.
And so if over the winter months and you're not biking, you will lose that motion, no doubt. So you're somebody who's going to have to work to maintain their motion 12 months out of the year.
And I would, to be honest, you may want to invest in a stationary bike if you don't have one, because that's a really nice way. I think you need, 105, something like that, to get around on a bike. And so that would be one way to really make sure that you maintain that range of motion, Jim, especially if you like biking outdoors.
Yeah, right. Jim, good luck. Thank you. Valerie in Appleton emailed us. Their 12-year-old daughter has been complaining about knee pain in both knees after easy activities, even just walking. She has a little bit of a turned-in foot on her right side. Could her foot be causing the pain in her knees? Anything else she should see, or anyone else regarding this issue? And if so, what type of doctor?
So it sounds, so the in-toeing may be causing some patellofemoral pain. She may have some weakness in her hips. It's hard to tell on a 12-year-old girl if she's gone through that growth spurt yet or not. So she could be at that point where her long bones have really grown, but her muscles haven't remodeled up to that. She could have Sinding-Larsson-Johansson disease. She could have Osgood-Schlatter's disease, a couple things, apophysitis type things. So I would definitely see a physical therapist. A 12-year-old girl should not have pain with walking. That's not normal.
Right. And just, you know, her foot is turned in. Normal posture is turned out about 7 degrees.
Yep.
So if you're turning in, you're way a couple standard deviations outside the norm. So I would absolutely get her in to see somebody, because this is the age where girls drop out of activity.
That's right.
For a number of reasons. And so now if she has a physical condition, that's just going to be one more thing to keep her out of being athletic. She needs to stay in the game as she progresses into her teen year. So I would absolutely get her in. You could start with a primary. You can see a physical therapist without a referral. And get a look there, but get her in to see somebody, absolutely.
And on that note, we are out of time. I want to thank you both, as always, for being with us, and we will look forward to your visit next month. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for the great questions.
Bye.
Jill Tide-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, and Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And they'll be back long about this time next month, and we will do this all over again. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of how it works. Coming up tomorrow on the show, last week was National Library Week, so this week we're checking in with libraries from around Wisconsin, and then we hear about a cookbook celebrating the TV show Happy Days. Remember that show? I remember it sort of fondly, I guess. But there's a good cookbook out there. We'll talk about that tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.